Well, this is Current Yield Grant's Interest Rate Observer of the Air, and I am Jim Grant. With me, as always, is the great Deputy Editor of Grants, Evan Lorenz, and Henry French as our sound engineer, as per usual. And we have a guest today, and his name is Sean Usmer. He's CEO of a company called Triple Flag. And we'll get to Sean in just one moment. In the meantime, Evan, this is high cotton times for the critics of fiat currency and a crazy credit. Do you have any sightings you might contribute to this discussion, Evan?
Yeah, it's the weirdest juxtaposition in the world. On the one hand, we have some of the tightest spreads in high yield credit out there, which is usually a sign that things are going swimmingly well. And on the other hand, we got a report yesterday saying nearly 10% of rated private credit issuers are under covenant relief. And of those under covenant relief, just over a third of them can't even cover their interest expense out of EBITDA, not even operating income. They're essentially insolvent entities in a benign economic environment and at a time when creditors are, you know, pricing things as if everything's hunky-dory.
Yeah, there was news also about a new high in the so-called dividend recapitalization. So if you say you're a private equity promoter, right, you buy a public company, and what do you do next? You borrow, right? Okay, so you've loaded up with debt, and then you pay yourself a dividend on top of the debt, and then you wait, what?
Oh, wait, does that dividend come from cash flow?
No. Then you wait, what, 6 or 8 weeks?
And, if you're patient.
Then dividend recap. It seems as if this is a fine time to focus on that monetary asset, which is unencumbered by credit risk. And Sean, that is the cue for our discussion about Triple Flag. And I would like to begin by recollecting the source of the name. I got to say, Sean is from originally from South Africa, but most peripatetic career. But he might not be familiar with the thing that with a product that one most typically associated with Triple Flag. What's that?
Gold?
Insect killer. Triple Flag, right? Or is it Double Flag? Anyway, Black Flag. Oh, Flag. Okay, so Sean, tell us about, if you would please, about this business you're in, which is strikes. We wrote a first article on Triple Flag. We've repeated it several times. And to declare an interest, I am a fan and personal interest in this company. But tell us, if you would please, the nature of your business such that you can run it with a headcount of what, 3 or more?
You could. As a public company, it's more. But I know it's been a number of years now since we first connected, and it's been a great journey. So, as you remember, I think in fact we just turned 8. We started off. I left Barrick, where I was CFO, to start this company with capital from Paul Singer and Elliott Management, for very much the same reasons for the introduction of your show, which is just this sort of mistrust of what's happening with monetary policy, spending. And the idea was really, can you get diversified, managed top line exposure to gold and silver in a portfolio which would allow for growth, cash flow which you could reinvest, pay a decent dividend, and form a really good vehicle for a way to get precious metals exposure. And I guess, having always been on the mining side of things, you know, the mining sector struggles very often to get traditional forms of capital. As you know, it's a long-term capital deployment business. And so the idea of having to wait with timelines that may not align for your next acquisition, your next growth window, presents opportunity. And so for us, we're really providing more structured finance, very often the buy streams and royalties. And so what it does, it provides the miner with patient, structured capital at a competitive rate to complement debt and equity. And at the same time, it provides us with, really, it's been in 8 years since 2017, our first full year, we've had the highest growth rate in the sector in actual ounces, 20% cumulative annual growth rate year on year, and a 34% growth in cash flow.
Let's back up a moment for the benefit of people who might not be familiar with the nature of a royalty and streaming company. Is not the distinguishing feature that do you have an interest in the top line rather than, as many equity investors do, exclusively in the bottom line? Can you explain the difference?
I can. So I think some of your audience may be familiar with royalties when it comes to things like entertainment or otherwise. But in mining's context, essentially, usually you have a share of the revenue or a share of the product. where you're not picking up the ongoing sustaining capital or operating cost exposure. And for those of you more familiar with mining, what typically happens, equities are valued on the basis of what you can see visibly, statistically proven over a life of mine plan in the ground. The beauty of this model is you provide an upfront payment, either for royalty or stream. You get a percentage of either the ongoing top line revenue or the physical product. And you get that over, these are evergreen contracts, so they remain over the life of mine. So it participates not just through pricing cycles, which you get, but as the miner rationally invests money in exploration, expansion, extending mine life to grow value, you participate over time. And so what that means is you get this, and when costs go up, as we just lived through and we're still experiencing, that is borne by the operator and not by the streamer. So it's been very, very helpful for us in this inflationary environment.
Yeah, there's for every successful business model, there's generally a preceding story that is magical in the leverage of idea to pay out. And in the case of private equity, what evidence like the Gibson Greetings transaction with Bill Simon in 1970 something, they put up like $5, wound up taking $5 billion, right, something like that. Anyway, with in the mining area and in the royalty and streaming area, it seems to me, Sean, you can correct me if I'm simplifying too much, but I think that the kind of the Bill Simon, so to speak, of the royalty and streaming business might be Pierre Lassonde.
Yes.
Or Seymour Schulich, and together they formed something called Franco-Nevada. And Pierre loves to tell the story, and who wouldn't tell it about the first deal? It was they bought 4% of a small Nevada mine for what, $2 million, I think.
And that's right.
And Pierre is very affectionately recalls this, as one would, and he says less than a year later, Western State sold out to Barrick Gold Corp now, which probably discovered the now lovely Gold Strike mine. The royalty had paid out when we talked to Pierre less, more than $1 billion, and it's still, and $1.5 billion. And it just, so from $2 million to $1.5 billion, that is called a rate of return.
A pretty good one.
Yeah. So, however, Sean, this is preface to a question about the risks inherent in even this model portfolio. So Franco-Nevada, which is the Pierre and Seymour's founding, their founders, and it's their baby still, even though it's a public company. Anyway, they got socked by the most extraordinary example of governmental perfidy in Panama. And so the stock got clobbered. They had right of $10 billion of Sunqua, I think, something like that. But that's political risk. And political risk is ubiquitous. I think it was Bill Barr, the former attorney general, briefly under President Trump, who said that in this country, too, we have political risk. He said that, and for example, in the presidential election this fall, the choice is between national suicide or Russian roulette, I think is the way he put it. So political risk is certainly not exclusive to worlds that we not always would care to visit on vacation, but it is it's still a risk. So with that windy preface, Sean, tell us, if you would please, about this episode in Panama. Tell us about your exposure to similar risks and how you manage those exposures and those risks.
Yeah, so it's there's a lot there. And when you think, as say, Franco-Nevada is, if you look at their journey and the returns and clearly the founding story, which is now folklore, it's been an incredible ride until they've recently obviously had this Panamanian situation. So our founding was the idea of creating a high growth Franco-Nevada vehicle. So gold, silver without the oil and gas, because they've had a very successful run on oil and gas, and our backgrounds have been really more in metals and mining. And so that's what we've sought to do. And the idea is strategically commit more of your capital in lower risk producing assets with good land packages, good life ability to extend mine lives or expand. And to generate that cash, you can reinvest. And then to your point, even you going back to Franco's founding example, it's not like someone flicked a switch, put $2 million in, woke up like 5 years later and had $1 billion in the bank. Mines take, on average, nearly 20 years now from discovery to develop. Permitting, all these government regulations and that are taking longer. So the reality is you want a model where you have diversified high margin cash flows, good optionality, and then a bucket of longer dated options, which could be the next Franklin Nevada. And so you'll see that in our portfolio now with 234 assets, 32 of those produce that cash flow you talked about earlier. So you've got this big repository, which really investors aren't focusing on, which could contain, if not the next gold strike, at least some subset of those are going to contribute meaningful ounces and growth on a longer, medium to longer term horizon. And that's what makes this model so compelling, is shorter growth, high margins, and then longer dated optionality, which you don't have to fund. So specifically your question on Panama, you know, it's interesting. I was on a vacation with my wife, our anniversary in January down in Costa Rica. And our driver, who knows nothing about mining, was suddenly an expert on Panamanian mining. And I think, you know, the reality that he seemed to have this view, I guess, through the local media, that the locals woke up one morning and someone had stuck a copper mine on their doorstep. And this is an outrage. But there were billions of dollars invested by First Quantum in there. And I think what really happened is the government, with the capital sunk in that, looked to renegotiate the deal. And I think lost control of it at that point. And, you know, people will have their views. But what ultimately happened is they've taken, I think it's 5% of their GDP and erased it for the time being. And they lost control of the beast. They've just gone through an election. And, you know, with that, Franco really provided a large part of the risk capital to First Quantum to build that mine in return for that very lucrative stream, which I think was about a quarter of their NAV, roughly.
Yes.
So you can imagine with the government doing that, and then the Constitutional Court saying, oh, no, this is not legally constituted. This mine cannot continue. That was a big blow to their stock. And, of course, I think a loss for the country. I mean, everybody talks about energy transition. Turns out you need copper for that. So I suspect at some point, hopefully, sanity will prevail. And I do think that Franco is quite well positioned. These contracts are typically quite defensively positioned compared to equity. So usually they're, you know, if they don't have parent guarantees, they're often either senior or second secured. You're trying to be as bankruptcy remote as possible and have an enforceable contract. And you'll find with them, given the importance of this, they'll tend to likely be patient. And I suspect they'll, if they don't recover it or get it to resume at some point, you know, I think they should be fine. But to your specific point on country risk, really what we're building is a managed portfolio that is diversified. And it's diversified, I mentioned the number of assets, but it's diversified by region, by operator. And you can achieve, because this is a passive portfolio, I'm not managing management teams of mine sites. We have good relationships, but you're not doing that on a day-to-day. You can achieve a level of diversification that you can't replicate operationally. So what that means when it comes to country risk is you have to look at the portfolio construction to think, is this acceptable if the wheels fall off? Because weird things happen sometimes. And so for us, to your point, you know, Franco lost their cornerstone asset, or at least for the time being, the NAV has been impaired. I think they've taken a complete write down on that. In our case, our single biggest cornerstone of a similar percentage of NAV is North Parks, which is a copper mine that's been going for 30 odd years in Australia, 5-hour drive from Sydney. And it's got decades of mine life ahead of it. So jurisdictionally, if you've got Panama on one hand with no mining tradition, where things have not gone well, and you've got a situation in Australia which has a proud mining tradition, an incredible ecosystem, and we think about country risk, my biggest country concentration is actually Australia, an area I've operated in for 20 odd years now. And then it's the United States and Canada and parts of South America, which have got a good mining history. That's about 80% of our NAV. And then when we go to more exotic jurisdictions, you mentioned a point moments ago that people really don't appreciate. Country risk is not as simple as something open up a Fraser Institute you know, document or table and saying, oh, this place looks pretty good. It's pretty hard to try and permit a new mine in parts of the United States, in Canada. Like, pick your jurisdiction. There's a lot of NIMBYism, I think, that also goes on, and a lot of these jurisdictions make it pretty difficult to get the necessary permits to build the mines that, ironically, they need in their, you know, devices or in their electric vehicles or elsewhere. So when you step back from that, I think the specifics of where the mine's located, their social license to operate, because ultimately what happened in Panama was they lost their social license to operate. And so you have to be able to, when you write these contracts, on your due diligence, look through the operator, because very often these contracts will be around a lot longer than any particular management team. Have they got the right orientation? Have they got a good social license to operate? If they're in conflict with their governments or with their host communities, they can't just pick up the mine and go somewhere else. So that's a large part of it. And then on the portfolio construction, what percentage exposure in a diversified portfolio do you have for any particular jurisdiction? So just to drive that home, our second deal was in Wolfar Fairway, and it wasn't Australia or North or South America. It was in Mongolia at a time when Rio was having a tough time with the government, where they've invested billions. We wrote a modest check for the size of our portfolio. It was a high teens return to compensate us for the risk. Greenfield site, which we could easy diligence. And the net result of that, though, is I wanted a four-year payback because I didn't know what the next administration would look like and whether they'd be more business-friendly. The election happened. It's gone well. It developed the mine. I think already we've made about 160% on our original investment, and they've extended mine life by a decade. So that's the sort of thing when we look at country risk and exposure and proportion of the portfolio, certainly how we've tried to think about that.
Around the world, 2024 is a big year for elections, and it seems like populism is on the rise. Is resource nationalism also on the rise? And if so, what does that mean in terms of where you pick where to play?
I think the short answer has to be yes. You know, I think it's happening. You know, the supply chains and the globalization that we've benefited from and taken for granted for a long time, increasingly, I think, is fractured. And I actually feel, you know, with the Western lens, we are playing catch up and we are too short-sighted. You know, our time horizons seem to run within, you know, narrow election cycles, whereas the Chinese and others have been engaging in a very strategic way where they're not just trying to maximize the value within a narrow part of the value chain, which we tend to do, but really through the full value chain. They've been doing it quite successfully for long periods of time now. And so we've got on, whether it's critical minerals, energy transition or elsewhere, you know, governments are only starting to really, I think, realize what's needed. And it's not just the mineral endowments, it's the skills. We have an acute skill shortage. I think we actually have a generational cliff of talent that really we have to sort of backfill. And I think part of this is also intrinsically inflationary. You know, the reality is the critical minerals and things that we need for our future, a lot of these things have been locked up already. And these costs are going up. They've gone up quite dramatically just in the last number of years. So I think this is a chapter that's in its early innings, and I think there's more to come. And so, you know, for us, a lot of that is around the choice of jurisdictions that I've just already mentioned that I think are certainly lower risk. You know, they are very carefully diligenced up front. And then that diversification element is a large part of how we looked at it. If we're taking on slightly more risk jurisdictionally, you know, it's commensurate with the returns that, you know, we obviously seek from that. And we make sure that we don't go oversized from a NAV or an exposure from the portfolio.
Sean, you were born and educated in South Africa, which at one point was synonymous with gold mining. More recently, the country has run into all manner of difficulties, political, social, what have you. I don't know if you have any exposure to South Africa. Do you rule that out?
You do. Yeah. So, you know, I spent, you know, I left actually in 97 to go to Northwestern, do my MBA there, and with the full intention of going back as into operations, and ended up really in London in M&A with the scholarship provider. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time from time to time in this industry going back. It is a huge mineral endowment still, and I worked on empowerment and other transactions. But really, there's so much unrealized possibility and potential there. The infrastructure is not kept up. You'll see if you listen to Anglo American and others, a lot of reference to that. It's been well publicized, the challenges with electricity generation. I think when I left, Eskom was one of the lowest cost utilities in the world and had about 10% surplus capacity and was drawing in aluminum refiners. And that was, in fact, my second job was at Alisaf, because there was so much cheap, abundant power. And now there's, you know, shortages. So putting that aside and going back to your example with the US and other things, I think like any situation, the devil is in the detail. And if you look at an operator who has a good social license, has a good mineral endowment, has a good track record of operating in those regions, and perhaps doesn't have access to the sort of capital that we take for granted very often in a market like Canada, the United States, that creates opportunity. Mm. So probably 5 years ago now, and again, size for the portfolio, we looked at the bulk of our ounces actually come as byproducts. So I'm looking for gold and silver primarily. We're 95% gold and silver exposure. But often it's associated, like with North Parks, which is a copper mine. I stream gold and silver as a byproduct. Their cash flows traditionally were, say, 4 or 5 times EBITDA multiples to those companies. It's not strategic. For our investors, it's worth many times that. So it's a symbiotic form of financing. And when I look at the PGM space, so our material asset, we invested there. We wrote a $145 million check on a platinum mine, which was really, call it the sovereign wealth fund of a group they called the Bafokeng, a mine called Abi Plat. It's a multi-asset complex. And in return, they just bought out their newly built mechanized mine with Anglo Platinum, a mine called Staildrift, which you could stick that anywhere in the world. People would just go, wow, this is incredible. Beautiful infrastructure, a great mine, an incredible mineral endowment. And we wrote them $145 million check at a reasonable rate of return and got ourselves a 3-decade-plus stream, gold stream in the process. So for us, I could see that they had a great, impeccable social license. We put $100,000 scholarship program for the life of the mine alongside to benefit their host communities and their operators mm-hmm. as part of that social license. It would take a very brave government to go at odds with the actual community where you're providing employment and economic investment, schools, yeah. housing, and all the things they do impeccably. And so that's where my point about the devil in the detail, a very high quality management team that we knew and trusted.
Yeah.
And, you know, we knew that they didn't have issues, constraints related to power and infrastructure. So that's where the diligence comes in and the portfolio construction. So that's how we've looked at that.
Sean, when we spoke about 3.5 years ago, I asked, what about the flow of ideas that come your way? That must be a big part of your franchise, is having a network of knowledgeable people to furnish you with the next opportunity. And a member of your team said that you typically find 25 or so unsolicited deal proposals dropping over the transom every quarter. And the hit rate was only 1 in 32. Could you elaborate on that and perhaps reflect on how this pertains to the difficulty of mining gold, its scarcity, and all the geological and economic hurdles in the way of actually producing it?
Yeah, so when we started in 2016, I'm sitting in Toronto just off Bay Street, and I'd say the narrative with the Brains Trust and the banks here was you're competing with the great Franco-Nevadas and others. There's nothing to do here. Good luck with that. And we felt that really, going back to my earlier comments, that there's actually an opportunity here for an underserved mining community to commit smart capital. And that's really, I think our track record demonstrates that we've been able to do that. But as you move forward with, you know, this investment, in the beginning when you're private, your path to deal flow is really through your networks. We put a lot of, as former executives, where like when I was Barrick CFO, we had too much debt. I had $13.1 billion in debt. Had to get the cost structure right, reduce G&A, reset the mine plans, sell off non-core assets, but you're selling EBITDA, so you've got to be careful. You've got to get a good enough multiple. And we did a stream as part of that. And so that same sort of knowledge and mindset, and also the appreciation that there's only a few guys who know how to structure these deals and diligence them, and it isn't actually a straight IRR shootout, which most people don't appreciate, has informed how we've gone about deal flow, how we go to miners, we do the proactive legwork, we'll say to them, look, we know we're ultimately competing with conventional forms of financing, or we're complementing it. We invest through the cycle, so there's periods when you know things are at a low. You know that equity is expensive, maybe they have got too much debt, and you're investing and helping them, particularly with byproduct financing, to improve their balance sheet in a non-dilutive way to their investors. Other times, they're looking at acquisition financing, where they're looking for a trusted partner who can work alongside debt and equity, deal with the intercreditor, and know that they will help them execute their deal and not get jammed. Other times, it's liberating a non-core portfolio of assets that are undervalued by the market. And sometimes it's mine development financing where you're sharing risk and return for higher returns. That ebbs and flows. So to your point, when we were private and we were an unknown quantity, there was a disproportionate amount of time going and putting ideas in front, enjoying rejection, and occasionally converting some of those. I think the challenge now, being public and being more of a household name, is that I think the track record is clear. And what we found is we get a lot more passive inbounds. I mean, today alone, I've had several. And it's a common feature. And I actually think our pipeline right now in this very minute, in fact, this year has been the busiest in our history. I think the challenge for us is you have to really be disciplined, because a lot of that I would describe as low calorie. It's stuff that it can take up an awful lot of resource. And in many cases, it's not truly transformational. So you've got to dedicate very proactively only so much of your time to those opportunities. Think about, if I convert this, what does it truly do for the portfolio returns, diversification scale on your journey, versus something where it might be lower probability, but be truly transformative. So why this matters to me is we're shareholders. We have the highest insider ownership of any of our peers, intermediates or seniors. Everything we do is through that lens. And so when we started in 16, our nearest intermediate peers at that time, when we were doing zero, were doing 40 and 50,000 ounces a year. Last year, we did 105 and they were in the 90s. This year, we're the only group out of intermediates and seniors that's actually showing an increase in guidance. All of them are down to flat. So that combination of high margin cash, good cash on net invested capital, and continuing to invest wisely is key. And I think to you know, your point, I think we've seen well over 800 opportunities now for the deals that we've done over time. Those 234 assets were in 234 separate transactions. Things like, we took over Mavericks just over a year ago as a smaller peer, which had about 140 odd assets, of which 14 were producing, which was 55% of the NAV. You know, that brought along these longer dated options as part of the mix. All of that is informed through what's the right thing to add sensible accretive growth per share. And, you know, I think the environment now is probably in a point where everybody's got NVIDIA fever, and, you know, the mining and other equities are not exactly seeing the benefits flow through into their stock with higher prices in gold and silver. It's a very busy environment for us.
Sean, I'd like to ask you about an analogy and lead that into a question. So in the airline industry, airlines in general are leveraged. They have wafer thin margins, and it's a cyclical business where they, you know, cyclically go bankrupt. But at the same time, because they have bad balance sheets, they turn to the airline lessors, the people who actually own the aircraft. These companies tend to have good balance sheets, which they leverage to actually buy planes more cheaply from OEMs than the airlines could themselves and lease the planes. And as a result, because they operate with long-term leases, they tend not to have the cyclicality. Like, airline lessors actually generated profit during the great financial crisis, whereas airlines went bankrupt. And you mentioned when you were the CFO of Barrick, and Barrick was over-levered and running into problems, you turned to royalty streamers to actually finance your projects. Is that a fair analogy?
Yes and no. It's an interesting analogy, which I think a few people fully appreciate. You know, the airline industry, the life of those assets, I don't know, what is it, 30 years or so, they're trying to, everybody gets greedy at the same time, everybody gets fearful at the same time. And in theory, you're trying to be counter-cyclical. So the downfall, I think, of our sector certainly very often has been poor capital allocation choices with an equity investor pool that's often, you know, historically generalist, that all want growth at the same time. And then, you know, they want discipline along the way. And unfortunately, management teams demonstrate discipline, they show buybacks, and then, hey, guess what? One day everybody's found religion, they want the new mines. And I mentioned earlier, it's taking longer. It's like decade-long timeline sometimes to bring new mines on. So I think the parallels are there and they're interesting. I do think, unlike the example that you've mentioned, for us, this has to be, you can't have a winner and a loser if it's a long-term capital deployment game. I do think the part that is underappreciated is that, you know, this form of funding can be competitive and symbiotic, but also it really rewards over time our investors as miners are successful, that they explore and they expand. And then we get to participate and we get that ride or that free participation. So it isn't a one-hit overnight wonder in those regards. So the problem is, if you've got a miner that is struggling along the lines of what you said, they're over-levered, you know, their operations aren't successful, or they're down, that has an impact on you. It doesn't have the same impact because, for example, to illustrate the point, COVID, we you recall everybody in their basements, and we had two jurisdictions in the portfolio, South Africa and Peru, where we lost, I think it was 40, 45 and 54 days respectively, due to government mandated shutdowns. I can tell you as an operator previously, what would have happened is you've lost your revenue, but you still have a lot of fixed costs that you're carrying. So you got negative cash. As a streamer, you bear the, you know, you're not adding, if we were a debt financier, there's obviously interest accruing. So we lose the ounces over that period, but we haven't lost them, they're deferred. That's one of the benefits. Going back to your Barrick example though, you know, and this is the lens we use with when we're dealing with, you know, prospective partners. We looked at a stream, which we did on Pablo Villero for $610 million opposite Royal Gold, where it was really Royal Franco and Royal with only three who could write the checks and structure the deals. But that was alongside selling a 10% joint venture interest to a, you know, a competitor or divesting other assets. You know, it was, you're always weighing these things up. You know, we looked at convertibles. You looked at the universe of the possible. So it wasn't a wholesale long-term encumbrance, if you will, of just saying, I have a cure for everything here. It's going to be a stream and multiple streams, and that's the way to go. I think, you know, you really have to, the management team has to understand their business, understand their resilience. And part of that for us is not just the partnership, it's also understanding on a forward-looking basis, if prices were to go down, we model actively, what does the fully levered situation of this business look like in their projected liquidity, similar to if you had a significant debt position, because we're not a buy-to-own shop. We don't want a situation where the miner is distressed. You know, we want them to be successful, invest money in the ground, explore and expand, and we benefit too.
Okay, that was a lead-in to ask about miners and the price of gold and their stock prices. So miners are operationally leveraged to the price of gold. If it costs a miner $1,000 to extract an ounce of gold and gold is $2,000, they get $1,000 in profit. If gold shoots up to $2,300, they get $1,300 in profit. If it falls to $1,700, it falls to $700. Since the start of 2023, the price of gold has shot up by 28% as we're recording today. But the Philly Stock Exchange Gold and Silver Stock Index, which is made up of gold and silver miners, is only up 12%. I would assume, just, you know, from the fact that they have operating leverage to this surge up in gold, that they would have actually outperformed the metal. What's going on, and what's your read for this?
I think there's a few factors. Firstly, a large part of the driver of the underlying commodity price rise hasn't occurred via investor demand in the West. I know there's a lot of stories that you would have picked up with, you know, consumers going into Costco and buying gold, physical gold that's on sale, paying a premium, and they can't keep the stuff in stock. And you know, we applaud that. But a lot of that has been a story of central bank buying Chinese bank. I think the weaponization of the dollar, people looking for alternatives, central banks buying, and the Chinese retail investors have driven up the underlying commodity price beyond certainly what the prognosticators had assumed, given the rate environment and what's going on. I think the equity story is a little different. So if you think in the West, we're not seeing we've seen outflows in ETFs. You know, we're not seeing a lot of focus on precious metals as a whole so far. Most people are underweight. I don't see a lot of evidence of generalist investor interest. They're all focusing on back at crypto, bizarrely, and NVIDIA and you know, name your risk on investment at this stage. It has been a story where I think both a bit of investor apathy, but more importantly, until very recently, we've seen supply chain disruption through COVID and then just beyond that, that has really impacted the capital cost profile of many, if not most, projects. And we've seen significant inflation. So what that's meant with the math you just shared is that when you would expect that fairly significant flow through on margins as prices rise, that hasn't occurred. We've seen a lot of margin compression because we've seen costs go up. We've seen capital costs and that go up. And I think the last quarter, and it's not a universal truth, not every issuer has reported this, but we have seen some like Agnico, Alamos, and others actually starting to see that margin flow through occurring to the investors and benefiting. So I think you're starting to see a bit of a bifurcation between some of the, you know, high quality names controlling costs, maybe less country risk and jurisdictional risk profile, going back to one of the themes from earlier, and others who either struggle with capital allocation, cost containment, and the like. So I think it's an opportunity for the future for that flow through to occur, but you've not seen it en masse so far.
Sean, in conclusion or in semi-conclusion, there's this phrase called forward-facing metals, by which people seem to mean copper principally, but also some of the rare earth thing. And I don't know, I am of the view, perhaps you share some of this, that the forward-facing metal par excellence is gold, because it is facing forward to the gales falling from the eyes of the world so far as the institution of fiat currencies and top-down interest rate manipulation. And I'm inviting you to say something nice about this forward-facing monetary asset that seems to have taken a back seat to a mere copper. Has the streaming business, royalty and streaming business, is it turning its back on gold in some way, or the miners themselves looking to diversify because they have given up on this, as they would call it, pig?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. I mean, look, we're unashamedly gold and silver focused for very much along the lines of, you know, what you've sort of outlined here. It's funny, you may have picked it up, but probably 3 months ago, the Financial Times ran an article which said, hey, we're seeing these record gold prices, but some of the sector leaders are just talking about their copper portfolios. They said, like, if you've got the sector leaders not exactly espousing the virtues of the primary commodity that they're focused on, like, why should they get investors to focus on this? So, you know, I think to your point, where I was actually in Philadelphia with some investors just last week, where one mentioned a friend of theirs from my home country who used to invest in Kruger Rands and said, you know, help me understand why they would do that versus something else. And I said, well, let me take you back to my first home in my 20s. My mortgage rate at the time was 23.5%. And so the idea of putting money in the physical hard asset with against that inflationary backdrop as a preserve of value is something that I think people in a more stable environment don't truly appreciate. And there's so much of the world that does get that and actually sees the importance of that, which I think is often why, you know, you are seeing the attraction with whether it's Chinese retail or others for a hard asset that has stood by for millennia over time. And I mean, look, you'll know the numbers better than me, but what is it, the U.S. Federal debt number, what, $34 trillion or something? I think it's gone up from, what, 60% of GDP to 120% over the last 20 years. I've just had my damn taxes as of next week. Already more than half my income goes to, you know, my income tax to the government in Canada. They're running big deficits, and this is not a theme that's unique to them. So it's unsustainable. And so I cannot see how, if governments lack the will and also with these debt service costs that are continuing to mount and are going to make tough choices for ourselves and for future generations, how something like gold as a store of value in this moment is not relevant, more relevant now than perhaps certainly in my lifetime.
That is an inspiriting speech. In fact, I'm gonna not forget that. Sean, what a pleasure it is to have been speaking with you. This is Sean Osmar, CEO of Triple Flag Precious Metals Corporation, TFPM, on the New York Stock Exchange. And it's been lovely. So thank you. Thank you, Evan. And,
likewise.
Yeah. And Henry, thank you for making it sound as if we're doing this for a living. That's good. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, we'll talk
so much,
again
yeah.
soon. Okay. So long, Sean. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening. This is Current Yield Grants Interest Rate Observer of the Air.